Really excited for today's talk. I'm joined, as always, by Joseph Wang, aka Fed Guy. Joseph, welcome back.
Hey, Jack. Great to be here.
Yeah, so we've got a lot to talk about. There's the inflation CPI print that comes out on Thursday. We're, of course, recording on Tuesday, February 8th. But Joseph, I want to talk about Europe. Last week, we sort of foreshadowed what was to come with the Bank of England meeting and the ECB meeting. And we have a lot of news. The Bank of England hiked rates, indicated that they would continue to hike rates. And Christine Lagarde, president of the European Central Bank, ECB, indicated that, you know, she did not take rate hikes off the table.
We will not be complacent, but we're not going to be rushed into a process. We will follow the sequence that we have set for ourselves. We will verify the forward guidance criteria, and we will be gradual in whatever we do.
And you've seen bond yields revolt, essentially, especially on the front end of the curve. All these rates have gone up, and the markets are pricing in greater hikes. How have you made sense of this phenomenon this past week from the ECB and Bank of England?
I think what's happening is that there is just a fundamental sea change in the central banking community. Basically, they've come to realize that they've made this ginormous, ginormous policy error. So what we see in the Eurozone, we have inflation, 5% in some countries, I think 10% in countries like on the eastern side of the European Union. And rates are negative 50 basis points, right? So, and not just that, they're still buying assets. So what's going on? You have negative rates, huge inflation prints, and you're buying assets. That doesn't make any sense. And if you watch Lagarde's press conference last week, I think she was kind of, you know, she was kind of, I got the sense she was kind of a bit helpless and she wasn't sure what to do. So obviously the right course of action here is to start reducing monetary policy, reducing accommodation. That's true in the ECB, and it was also true in the Bank of England as well. I think the surprise last week wasn't that the Bank of England hiked rates. The markets were expecting that. Is that there were also four other people on their committee that voted for a 50 basis point hike. So they were more hawkish than I think the market expected. And this is something that's happening globally. We seem to be in a fundamental regime change where we're moving towards an inflationary, global inflationary cycle that we haven't seen in a very long time. And all our institutions and all our current stance of policy is built for a world where inflation is very low and expected to continue to be low. And so for the first time in a very long time, everyone is becoming more hawkish. They're raising rates and they're reducing their asset purchases. Now, this is particularly a big deal for the ECB because the ECB plays a very big role in keeping together the European Union. So if you guys remember, let's say a few years ago, we had this European sovereign debt crisis where some of the weaker sovereigns, their borrowing costs were much higher than the stronger solvents. Let's say the spread between Italian BTPs and German bunds. And that's a huge problem for a country like Italy or Portugal, because they're not like the US. They don't have their own central bank that can print money. In a sense, they're kind of on the gold standard. So when their borrowing costs go up, you know, they actually don't have that money. And if it becomes really, really difficult for funding themselves, then it makes a lot more sense for them to just devalue and get out of the Eurozone. And so if you have high borrowing costs, rather than just raise taxes and just impoverish the people, it makes sense. And you'll see more separatist movements than you did back then. So the ECB stepped in and they kind of saved the day by buying these peripheral sovereign debt and compressing the spreads between the periphery and the core. So the ECB plays this very important political role in holding together the union. Now, as we walk into a world that's more inflationary and the ECB is thinking about walking back its accommodation, it's kind of boxed itself in because it's committed to not increase rates until it stopped asset purchases. But if it stops asset purchases, then you see spreads widen as they already are. And you have political implications. You know, you could have more and more clamors of leaving the Eurozone like you did during the last European crisis. So there's this difficult task it has to do between balancing the its role as a central bank, but also it's kind of this unspoken role of helping keep the European Union together. And I think that's what's happening right now. So you see the sovereign, you see the bonds, all rates rise because of the hawkish impulse, but you also see spreads widen because of because of the prospect of reduced ECB purchases, which has to happen before any rate hikes.
Right. So we have this chart here from Bloomberg showing the spread between Italian yields and German 10-year yields. The idea being that when that spread widens, that indicates a preference for less risky assets such as German bonds, because Germany is it's an economic powerhouse within Germany, has a huge current account surplus, a trade surplus, whereas Italy is kind of on the other side of the shop. And you're saying that the quantitative easing done by the ECB, that helped temper that spread, but that spread is now widening. So I'm curious as to your thoughts on the implication of that.
So again, ECB is thinking about doing two things. It's stopping quantitative easing, its asset purchase program. That's precondition to raising rates, which Lagarde said might happen, maybe, later on. And so when you're thinking of reducing asset purchases, that impacts the longer-dated rates and the spread. So you see those go higher and spreads go wider. And when you're thinking about lifting the short-term rates, that impacts the front end of the curve, and you see that going higher too, as you noted. So that's just reacting to monetary policy. I think the problem is that I'm not sure that there's going to be enough private sector buyers for, let's say, periphery sovereign debt without the ECB. The ECB played a really big role, even though the quantities purchased weren't that large. Just the thought that the ECB was here supporting the market was a big force in keeping those spreads bound. Now, if the ECB is leaving, then you have to find new buyers, and it's not clear what price those buyers will emerge. It's the same problem throughout the world, by the way. Even at the Fed, the Fed owns $5.5 trillion in treasuries, almost a quarter of the entire agency MBS market. When the central bank leaves, you're going to have to find new buyers, and it's not clear what prices those buyers would emerge at. So this is it's a big unknown, not just for the ECB, but for all the central banks.
And Joseph, to what degree do you think the European Central Bank is pleased with this run-up in rates? Obviously, when they indicate that they're going to think about hiking rates and that they're not taking it off the table for 2022, you want the market to believe you if you're a central banker, right? But it seems like the market has been extremely vigorous in its belief. So that I've seen some people say that these are the biggest upward moves in European rates in years. And in fact, Julian Brigden on Twitter just noted that the one-year euro swap, it looks like GameStop pretty much. If you look at that chart. So is there a point at which central bankers at the European Central Bank get concerned that that rates are rising so quickly?
I think the whole point of them doing this is to increase the level of rates. They see inflation is very high, they think. So Lagarde says that their forecasts have upside risk. That's a polite way of saying that, yeah, I think inflation is going to go even higher. So in their toolkit, naturally, they want interest rates to go higher. So when they see this, things are working as expected. What they don't like seeing, though, is that the peripheral spreads widened. Then that's an issue of the transmission of monetary policy and potentially, as they would say, redenomination risk. So they don't like that. They like the spreads to stay tight, but levels to go higher. But the problem is that the spreads don't stay tight unless the ECB is buying. And if the ECB is buying, then it won't raise rates. So in order to raise rates, it has to stop buying. But this is a constraint that is arbitrary, really. It doesn't have to do that. You have someone at the ECB, the governor of Austria, Holzmann, suggested that, hey, maybe we can keep some of our asset purchases but raise rates. And that would make sense in their context, but that's not what they're going to do.
Mm. And Joseph, this is a really important point because it touches on a point you make in your most recent article on FedGuide.com about quantitative hikes. The sort of central, the Econ 101 type way of thinking about it is that if a central bank or any party buys bonds, the yield should go down. However, there are a lot of people who like to point out, we've talked about this before, that during periods of quantitative tightening or letting the balance sheet shrink, bond yields actually tend to rise and the yield curve tends to, bond yields tend to fall, people tend to buy more bonds, and the yield curve tends to flatten. But your statement indicates about Italy indicates that actually, no, when the ECB buys European bonds, it's good for the bonds, meaning that bond yields go down, and that when they withdraw their support, as they indicate that they might, the spread can widen. And this is, so I want to hear your thought on that. And particularly, in your most recent piece, you write, it's called Quantitative Hikes. You write, the Fed is raising rates across the curve through two mechanisms, hiking overnight rates and quantitative tightening. So can you just speak to how quantitative tightening actually, in some cases, can cause rates to rise, as the Econ 101 thinking would indicate?
So many things determine interest rates. And I know that, so sometimes, let's say the Fed stops doing QE and longer dated rates rise, but part of that is because there's a risk off move as well. Now, the Fed bought $5.7 trillion of treasuries. If you buy $5.7 trillion of anything, the price, it probably goes up a little bit, okay? So to say that, all this buying doesn't affect the price, that doesn't make any sense at all.
Joseph, number one, I don't know enough to disagree with you. But number two, I don't actually disagree with you. But just to play devil's advocate for the purposes of the show, because we're showmen here, we're all about the argument. If you look at, let's say, TLT or long-term bond yields in the U.S., didn't they reach their height before the Fed started QE? And, after the Fed started QE, it was pretty much a long, slow slog of pain for bond yields. Like, the market had already flattened the curve. It seems like the Fed, and I'm just talking about the Fed here in March of 2020, it seems like they bought at the absolute bottom in rates, and therefore rates could do nothing but rise, right?
Well, so I think there's a lot of things that go into what determines interest rates. And I think the sentiment when the Fed starts doing QE is that it's risk positive, and a lot of people just rotate out of bonds and into riskier assets like the S&P. So that's a factor as well. But just all things equal, though, I mean, if you buy more of something, it has a positive impact on their price. It's not the only thing that matters, but it has to have some impact. Now, to be fair, though, there's this study, it's a recent study by a bunch of academics, and they looked at the literature for quantitative easing, and they found something really interesting. Basically, if you work at a central bank, you think quantitative easing works, and it's great, and you get more promotions. If you don't work at a central bank, you think that it doesn't really work. So it is kind of black magic. The thing about all this stuff is that the market, it's a very complicated system, and it's really hard to isolate any single component. So that's why the studies haven't been so, I think, inconclusive. But just common sense, what would the world look like if there was an extra $5 trillion supply in bonds right now, right? I think interest rates would be a bit higher. Internally in the Fed, there's a recent speech by Fed President Esther George. She thinks that rates would be 1.5% higher if not for all the QE. And that seems like a lot. In a low rate world. But again, these are just estimates. I understand that when you look at what actually happened, sometimes when you do QE, yields actually go higher. And it's because it's not the only thing that impacts yields. When people say, don't fight the Fed, they're usually saying, don't short the market, because the Fed is going to make it go to the moon. The Fed doesn't want it to go to the moon anymore, right? The Fed is worried about inflation. It doesn't have a lot of tools to solve it. As we've talked about before, one of the tools it does have, though, is just kind of deflating assets a little bit. The way this works is if your net worth is a little bit lower, that means there's less demand in the system. And so that puts a little damper on inflation. If you hear what the Fed officials are saying, then they're telling you that, we're going to raise rates and buckle up. So don't fight the Fed goes two ways. So the Fed has a lot of control over interest rates, and that control over interest rates in a very direct way also impacts risk assets, because the people who invest in treasuries, fixed income, they also invest in equities. And when they lose on their treasuries portfolio, they rebalance and they sell some of their equities. And so it's a very direct relationship, and you already see it play out over the past few weeks. And I don't think the Fed is done yet, or it's fully priced in yet.
You've seen it play out. You're talking about the rise not only in short-term yields, but really the rise in Fed funds futures, Eurodollar futures. I think we've got a chart of that. This is the probabilities of the rate hikes for March 2022. Joseph, last week we were recording at a time when the 50 basis point hike of, it seemed like such a low probability, and the market assigned it, I'm just reading, like a 5% probability. Now we're at a solid 25% probability, as you can see in
the dark.
That's
the blowout jobs report.
Okay. So talk about that. And do you think that the odds are even higher?
So stuff like this, like if they do 50 basis points, it wouldn't be like 20%. It'd be like 100%, because they would come out, you'd have like 10 Fed persons come out and say, we think 50 basis points is a really good idea. We should do that. So first principle, Fed does not surprise the market. So they would telegraph that. If they haven't telegraphed it, it's not going to happen. So this isn't something you need to guess about.
So you think it won't happen?
No, well, so they still have time to telegraph it, but if they're not telegraphing it, it's not going to happen. So it's probably too late to telegraph it. They might do 50 basis points later on. It really just depends on how the data is. So when you have, the jobs report last week was expected to be weak, but was actually quite strong, and you had upward revisions in prior months. So the Fed looks at this, they're seeing, you know, an economy that's red hot. Wages going higher, employment is increasing, prices of everything are increasing, and they understand that they're just really, really, really behind, and this surprised them. They were all in on team transitory, and turned out to be not true. So they're probably going to get more aggressive. Actually, we can talk about how this actually works. So
yes, please.
So the Fed thinks about the world through interest rates, right? And so it wants to hike rates to be able to slow the economy down. And it controls rates right now through two mechanisms. It's the overnight rate and the balance sheet. So the overnight rate is the Fed funds rate.
Joseph, you've given me the red pill. It's actually the reverse repo rate.
It is the reverse repo facility.
Yeah, there you go. I'm paying attention.
So basically the reverse repo facility, it's the option to lend to the Fed. Basically, you can lend your money risk-free to the Fed at, you know, let's say 5 basis points a day. This is your backup option. The Fed will tell you what this overnight rate is going to be for the next few, let's say, months, few years, and you price your term rates according to this. Say the Fed says that I'm going to keep overnight rates 5 basis points, gradually raise it, you know, 5 times over the next year, then boom. When you price your one-year rate, it's going to be in reference to what you think the overnight will be. That's the Fed's toolkit to shape the, let's say, up to 5 years in the curve. Further out, no one has any idea what the overnight rate would be. So it's mostly supply and demand. So what the Fed does to shape longer term rates is to just go up, straight up and buy assets, buying trillions of treasuries. What it's doing now, it's raising the overnight rates. Market, as you showed, is pricing in 2.25 as the maximum it'll go. And then it's going to do quantitative tightening. We don't know how much they're going to do. They're saying they're going to do a lot. But when they're doing quantitative tightening, they're basically increasing the supply of longer dated treasuries in the market. Econ 101, higher supply, well, you know, prices go lower, right? Increase the supply of something, the prices go lower. So that's how it's supposed to work. How the short end risk works, that's really easy. How the longer quantitative easing, quantitative tightening works, that's a lot harder to guess. And like we just talked about, no one knows for sure, but usually if you sell a lot of stuff, the prices go down. So that's what the Fed is doing. Now, this feeds directly into the entire market. The reason being that people hold these assets, they're kind of forced to hold them because they're considered to be credit risk free. So rather than think about what the Fed is doing in terms of price, let's say increasing the rate from 1% to 2%, another useful way is to think of it in terms of quantities. Let's say I have like $100 worth of treasuries. Now maybe I have $98 worth. But this kind of reverberates through the financial system, because a lot of people hold diversified portfolios where when they lose on one asset, they sell some of the other to rebalance. If you have a $1 billion portfolio, $500 billion in equities, $500 billion in treasuries, and let's say your treasury portfolio declines because of these rate hikes to 480 billion from 500, then you know what you do is you have to sell $10 billion in equities to rebalance so that you're again 50-50 equities and treasuries. And this happens at such a large colossal scale, like in the trillions, that you necessarily have to have some disruption in risk assets. But you really can't afford that either, because listen, so last week we had like Facebook earnings, right? Facebook imploded by 25%. Now Facebook is a $1 trillion company. You're not supposed to have $1 trillion companies trade like penny stocks like that. That tells you the market is fragile. There's not a lot of liquidity. So small amounts of sales can have big impacts in price. And so that's why I think the market is quite fragile. And if the Fed further tightens, as some people expect it will, and does QE, you could have some serious dislocation in the risk markets.
So much to dig in there, Joseph. I'd start by saying that the Federal Reserve hasn't hiked rates. All of the upsurge in short-term rates has been due to just its sort of talk to the market.
Forward guidance, come on, Jack.
Yes, I was seeing you up there. Yeah, exactly. And I was going to say that it's strange. You know, I was speaking to an investor recently who, as you will tell, has a way with words. And he said, Jack, the threat of the cancellation of free money from the Fed has investors seeking new underpants. And that line really stuck with me. And particularly, but I was thinking today, free money, actually, the higher rates go, the more free money it is, right? If the reverse repo facility was at 10%, that's 10% of free money that the Fed is giving banks. It's so strange that the more expensive money is, that just increases the value of low yielding term securities. So hiking rates will actually increase the amount of money in the system, but it will be more than offset by the fact that the value of fixed income instruments will go down just because the opportunity cost is greater because there's a just greater, you can get money from the repo, right?
Yeah. So I think that's right. So there is this inflationary impact from hikes, especially in the structure that we have today in a monetary system. So if you have a government that's basically, let's say, doing $1 trillion deficits and so forth, and has a very large stock of debt outstanding, well, where does it get money to pay the interest on that debt? You know, it just prints more treasuries, right? So when you increase interest rates, the largest borrower in the world, the federal government, is just going to have to print more treasuries to pay you. So there's that weird dynamic that we did not have in the past, but we have now because of just how our financial system is structured, where there are inflationary impacts from rate hikes.
Can you speak to the importance of this chart here, just how many treasuries are owned by parties that aren't the Fed? What does rate hikes do to the people who own this?
So when you think about, like I mentioned, when you think about treasuries as rate hikes, as the Fed basically just forcing haircuts or decreasing the market value of your treasury debt, right? It's giving you losses into the system, into the financial system. Now, these are losses because, think about it this way. If you're doing private debt, let's say I lend money to you, and then for whatever reason, the market value of that loan changes. Well, my loss is your gain, because my asset that is worth less, that loan I gave you, now that's a liability to you. So, you know, our total wealth in the world, it hasn't changed. It's just redistributed. So if I lent money to you and now it's trading 80 cents on the dollar, well, that means your liability is less, so your net worth is improved.
But for because my net worth is more improved, I'm more likely to lend, more likely to spend.
Yeah, and splurge and so forth. Yes. But that's completely different for the federal government. When the federal government, let's say we lent money to the federal government, $20 trillion, interest rates change, and the market value of that debt goes down to $20 trillion. Let's say now the federal government is you know a few trillion richer. But it doesn't care. It's not going to tax less. It's not going to spend more. So it doesn't affect its behavior at all. So when you have losses in sovereign debt, they're dead losses to the financial system. And the quantity of those losses is in direct proportion to how high the level of sovereign debt is. Now, if you think about what we see here, the sovereign debt load has just exploded during the last 20 years. Oh, it's wow. Oh, good old days, $2 trillion in sovereign debt. Well, I'm sure back then there are a lot of people complaining about out of control spending. And here we are. It's actually...
And Joseph, just ballpark, how much did the Fed buy in April and March of 20... Excuse me, March and April of 2020?
$1 trillion.
$1 trillion?
Yeah.
So that's like half of what the entire market was.
And then from then on, it's just every month they continue to buy a lot.
Right.
So when you shift rates, you mechanically just reduce the market value of all this stuff. And because the level of the debt is so high, the losses in absolute number are also very high. And that forces, you know, naturally forces large amounts of rebalancing. When you sell into illiquid markets, moves prices a lot. Have a taste of that. I think last month when we saw this hiccup in risk assets, it's been stable because I think the terminal rate hasn't really changed. But if you listen to some former Fed officials, and if you look at the data, 2.5, 2.25 as the highest that the Fed will go might not be realistic. And we haven't even really fully priced in quantitative tightening yet because we don't know what it is. But there's some upside risk for rates, which means there's some downside risk for risk assets, in my view. Oh, this is just showing just mechanically what it means when you hike rates. You take money out of the financial system. You reduce the market value of treasuries.
And so if we put up a chart of the one-year rate, the three-year rate, it would look like the exact opposite because yields up means the price goes down. This is an ETF that owns those fixed income instruments. Joseph, I've got a question for you, which is really hard for me to wrap my head around. So when the Fed hikes rates, people who own short-term debt instruments particularly, they go down in value. But you're saying the person who gains, my loss is your gain, by the way. Great. You're quoting a margin call, that fire sale scene.
So today it looks like my loss is your gain.
Yeah.
Is it the government? Because let's say, you know, you issue a bond that's par is 100 and the market value is 106. But then because of the Fed hiking rates, it goes from 106 to 104. The government still has to pay 100, right? When it comes back. So in what way is the government gaining? Because it's not like the government is short, right?
Well, no. Well, the government borrowed from you, so they are short treasuries. You're long treasuries. The government is short treasuries. They're on the
right,
other
but it's
side
not like they pay you back. They were going to pay you back at 106, and now they pay you back at 104. They're going to pay you back at 100 no matter what, right?
Well, it's the market value. So the market value, I mean, so the value is always changing with rates, like you mentioned. And so if you issued something at, let's say, 100 and then rates went down a lot, then your par value would go higher because it's worth more. But that would be the market values of the debt. Basically, the Fed, the government would owe you more in terms of valuation, would owe you more. But the cash flows, you're right, would just be, you just get par and you just get the coupons that were promised, but the market value would be different. It's like a time value of money thing. It's like a time value of money thing.
Right. So when you say the government makes money, is it that it gets to issue debt at cheaper levels?
No. So, yeah, well...
Because I thought the argument is, the Fed can't raise rates because the interest expense would be too high. But it sounds like you're saying when the Fed raises rates, the government gains.
Yeah, so basically all the debt that was low rates, so it was issued a bunch. It's like you have a mortgage rate that you borrowed at 2.25% last year, and now mortgage rates are 5%, right? So basically you lucked out. So your mortgage, if you discount it with the current rates, it's actually worth a lot less than you took it when rates are very low. So it's like a valuation discount cash flow valuation system.
Okay, that makes sense. Joseph, last week, or perhaps it was 2 weeks ago, you said that what really matters in terms of rising credit spreads, taking stocks down a peg, is not so much dragging interest rate hikes forward into the future, but the fact that the terminal rate will go higher, the terminal rate being the highest the market thinks that the Fed can go. We've shown when we showed the Fed funds futures chart earlier from CME that the odds of rate hikes for March have gone up. But what have you seen in terms of the terminal rates there? And you know, what are implications of that?
It looks like it's still 2.25. It hasn't really changed. The market seems fairly convinced that that's probably how high the Fed will go. If you listen to former Fed President Dudley, he thinks it can go higher. There's upside risk to that, and that I think that's right. But we'll have to see as if inflation really proves to be more persistent, as I think many people think, then I think the terminal rate will be higher. And if you rewind back to 2018, can you see in 2018 December terminal rates were as high as 3%, and the market just couldn't handle it, and it just kind of melted down all throughout December until the Fed finally, you know, changed its mind and started cutting rates. And so that to me just kind of tells me that that's probably the threshold, pain threshold, that the market could handle. So we're not there yet. We're like 100 basis points below that. And if we get there, I think that we could be in some shock.
Joseph, before we started recording, I told you I had a surprise for you.
Yes.
And this is the surprise. It's from Alex Gurevich's new book about the trades of March. And it's about just how over the past 30 years, let's say, the Federal Reserve has almost always been way more dovish than it indicates via its forward guidance. And I actually think let's look at this chart. This chart is showing that when it does an intermediate cut, it's always followed by an additional cut. Terrorist, 9/11, economic slump, tech bubble, and then this one is showing that the first Fed ease is following the end of a tightening cycle is incredibly short. So, for example, in 2018, after the Fed did its last hike, it started to ease only 7 months later. So the idea that the Fed hikes and then it has this whole Goldilocks period that lasts for years, Gurevich says, No. Typically, it's 6 to 12 months, and then once the Fed is done hiking, it's going to ease again. Number one, what are your thoughts on this of this phenomenon over the past 30 years? And number two, do you think we're playing a different ballgame because inflation is so high?
But can you repeat that? So he's saying that you would go higher, so they would hike, and there'd be a Goldilocks period. But in the past, the Goldilocks period is shrinking.
Yes.
Sorry. I see. The period between the Fed stops hiking and starts cutting. Is that?
Yes.
I see. Yes. I think that's kind of difficult to do now for a couple of reasons. One is that the Fed is just so much behind. It's going to be a lot more aggressive than it has in the past. Usually it's a bit more moderate, but this time I suspect that they're just going to be very aggressive. Maybe one hike every meeting, maybe even 50 basis points at one meeting in the future. And that has, I think, a very nonlinear impact on the financial system, because as I mentioned, the level of debt is so high that magnifies the impact of every rate hike. And so you can easily have times where, let's say there's a miscalculation or something breaks, and you could have a dislocation in the financial markets that in the past has usually led the Fed to quickly reverse course like they did in 2018. So I don't think we're on track to have this golden period. I think we're on track to just overdo it, just like we underdid it the last time, and just break something again. I think one thing that's interesting that's happening in the Fed is that the Fed is basically having being redone. You have a new board of governors coming, potentially, that it's being nominated. If you look at their credentials, they don't really have any. So they're basically political activists. And what a political activist does is that they're super dovish. So if that's the case, then we could have slower rate hikes. I think that could potentially put a longer distance between they start cutting again, because they were just raised so slowly. That would mean inflation is higher, but I think that would also lengthen a distance between these when they start raising and cutting, because the rate hikes would be so slow.
Joseph, we have the CPI number, the inflation number for January coming out on Thursday. That would be the 10th. What is your, how high will inflation have to, if we have a super high inflation print, do you think that would put a 50 basis point hike on the table? And if we have a super low print, would that, ease, how to what degree would that take pressure off the Fed?
I don't think the Fed would just pay attention. There's just one print. Usually they don't have a trend line and so forth. But it certainly adds urgency to what the Fed would do. So last month's jobs print was not as expected. I think going in, you had some people mentioning that, you know, this is disrupted by Omicron. My sense was that might have been to downplay the impact of that. And so despite Omicron, they have massive job gains. And so that, I think that just throws their calculation all off. Higher print, I don't think it'll put 50 basis points on the table in March, but it could later on.
Well, Joseph, it's been a great Tuesday morning with you as always. People can find your work at fedguy.com, on Twitter at fedguy12. Closing thoughts you want to leave our audience with?
I'm just the same thing I've been saying for the past 4 months, best 4 weeks. I want to be cautious in risk assets. So far, that's been good advice, yeah. We've been going straight down for the past 4 weeks almost, so I would just be cautious there. Not investment advice, of course.
Not investment advice. Yeah, it's only investment advice when everything I say is investment advice. No, I'm just kidding. Okay. Well, Joseph, thank you so much. Lastly, I've seen a lot of people indicating in the comments that they want to have a discussion between you and Jeff Snyder, who's known for his work on the Eurodollar system and the money market system. Well, if you don't know this, I'm just saying this now, I've actually reached out to Jeffrey, and he is amenable to that. So it probably will be in about a month or so. Jeffrey's very busy, but people who have wanted to see that, they will likely get their wish.
Well, awesome. Well, look forward to speaking with Jeff and you then.
Yeah, definitely. And I'm thinking if people want any other ideas for sort of special guests on the show, maybe someone like DC analyst, a money market specialist, let us know in the comments. Thank you so much, Joseph, and thank you everyone for watching.
Bye, everyone.